Welcome back to the Life on Target podcast. I'm your host, Nathan Spearing, bringing you my interview today with Rich Lusk, Pastor Rich Lusk. And I got to tell you that this conversation went a completely different direction than I expected, and I'm glad it did. I brought him on to discuss some of his points of view relating to his lecture slash sermon on Bring Your Guns to Church, which unfortunately has implications based on stuff that's going on currently in our country. But we also transitioned over to discussing family dynamics, husband and wife dynamics, things that manifest themselves in the church and how that's a reflection of the culture and how it shouldn't be, how the church should be immune to some of these confusions and things that we see in the culture, and why pastors need to not be afraid to confront women's sin, why husbands need to lead, but also how to cultivate brotherhood and friendship with other men, to have advice available to you when you're going through difficult times, how that should manifest itself in the church and in your family. So really enjoy this conversation with Pastor Rich Lusk. So Pastor Lusk, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me. Great to be here.
Fill everyone in, the listeners, on your family and vocational stats, if they haven't run in the CREC circles and, and haven't been familiar with you to date.
I pastor Trinity Presbyterian Church in Birmingham, Alabama, and have been here, I want to say, maybe about 19 years or so, maybe coming up on 19 years. So for a while. And God's been very gracious to us here. We're a CREC congregation, and been married for... 27 years, maybe 28 years this year, I think, to Jenny. And we got four kids, all of whom are grown and out of the house. Two are married, another engaged, and another's freshman in college, so she's not quite there yet. But a son is my oldest, and then three girls. And so they're all walking faithfully with the Lord. Couldn't be prouder of them. So that's a little bit of background on me.
What was the, maybe go a little further back in time for, you know, your upbringing and how you found yourself as a pastor, kind of what was the, your education like growing up and the path that God brought you along?
Yeah, that's great. So I was raised in a Christian home, and very thankful for God loving, God fearing parents. We moved around quite a bit, settled in the Chicago area. So that's where I had, you know, some very formative years, junior high, high school. Always went to public schools, almost always growing up. But, you know, my parents have been very faithful in teaching and training me, training my brother in the faith. And I certainly had no desire to be a pastor, but I did have a desire to walk faithfully with the Lord. And so when it was time to leave for college, I realized I didn't know the faith as well as I wanted to know it. And so I realized that the kind of, even though I read my Bible a lot, I knew I didn't understand very much of it. The kind of reading I had done was really mostly more devotional type reading, not very deep. And so I went to the Trinity Evangelical Divinity School bookstore to pick up a few books to take with me to college. And I really didn't know anything. I mean, I had been catechized a little bit in the shorter catechism, but I really didn't know the lay of the land very well theologically. And so I didn't really know what I was getting myself into, but I ended up buying a copy of Arthur Pink's The Sovereignty of God. And of course, that opened my eyes to a lot of things and made me a Calvinist before I even knew what that label was. I picked up a copy of Dietrich Bonhoeffer's book, The Cost of Discipleship, because I'd heard my pastor quote him and I knew the story, and I figured anybody that was trying to assassinate Hitler, you know, must be a good guy and have something to say. And that book was really an eye opener too, just in terms of helping me understand what it really means to be a disciple of Christ. When Christ calls a man, he bids him to come and die, as Bonhoeffer's famous line. He talks a lot about cheap grace versus costly grace in that book, and it's always stayed with me. And then I can still remember it. This was when the whole lordship controversy was going on with, you know, John MacArthur and Zane Hodges and people like that. And they had the blue book and the red book, you know, red pill, blue pill kind of thing. And I heard John MacArthur. So I picked up his book, The Red Book, The Gospel According to Jesus. And I read that. And it was a real eye opener, too, just in terms of the necessity of obedience and the importance of obedience. I don't know that MacArthur was as clear about the gospel in that book as he later would become. He corrected some things. But in terms of the necessity of obedience, the importance of being faithful and striving and fighting the good fight, all of that, it was a really, really helpful book for me to read. So that kind of launched me down this theological journey, but I still had no interest in being a pastor. I got involved in a campus ministry in college, and then the pastor ended up going to plant a church. I was pre-med, so I was headed down that track, and he left to go plant this church in Texas before my senior year at Auburn, and said, "Hey, you need to come work for me at the church. You know, if you want to go to med school later on, you can, but you definitely need to see if you're called to the ministry, because I think you might be." And so I did that. I ended up going out to Texas and going to work for the church and really never looked back. Worked at that church for several years, kind of a, you know, jack of all trades type position on staff at the church, did a lot of different things. And it was just a great experience. And I realized, yeah, this is what God is calling me to do. Ended up going to graduate school and studying philosophy at the University of Texas. I looked into going to seminary, but just the way things were at the church and the situation I was in, the session there of that church actually called me to an ordained position without a seminary degree, which is a little bit unusual, and I wouldn't necessarily recommend that for everybody. Well, yeah, really. I mean, it depends a lot on your situation, but I was in a situation where it made a lot of sense to do that. And I was able to pick up my languages, and all that. And so it worked out really well. I was in the PCA for many years, ordained in the PCA, ended up moving from that church in Austin, Texas to, what was known as Auburn Avenue, which was PCA at the time in Monroe, Louisiana, and then took this call to the church here in Birmingham. And God's been very good to me, very faithful. Everything's by the grace of God, of course, but, I'm very grateful for what God has enabled me to do as a pastor. I've very much enjoyed my calling as a pastor. It's not always easy, but again, it's not anything that I was, had you asked me when I was 20 years old, "Are you going to be a pastor someday?" I would have just laughed at you. But, that's often how it goes. We think we have things all mapped out, only to find out that God's got a different, very, very different route for us to take.
Yeah. I told, C.R. Wiley that's a rung up in my book, that you weren't, growing up wanting to be a pastor, and that God, basically drags you into it and pulls you into it. So did you graduate from Auburn then?
Yeah, sure did. Yeah. Yeah. So, and that's a long story in itself, but yeah, so graduated from Auburn and then moved out to Austin to work at the church. So yeah, one thing about that, I've heard people through the years say, if only become a pastor if you can't do anything else. And I think that's terrible advice. That's just terrible advice. I mean, I understand why somebody might say that, but, that's how you end up with a lot of underperforming, poorly qualified pastors.
Amen.
That's not the right way to think about it. You should become a pastor if it's clear that God is calling you down this pathway to ordained ministry. Obviously most Christians are not going to be, most Christian men are not going to be pastors. So, you can serve God in all kinds of different vocations, and that's perfectly appropriate. But obviously God desires to raise up faithful men, to serve as pastors in his church. And I would say, especially in our era, it's very important for a pastor to be competent, to have wisdom, to have courage, in order to be a skillful preacher and teacher of the word of God. You've got to be diligent. You've got to be a hardworking student of scripture. So, I don't think pastoral ministry should sort of get the leftovers. Oh, these are the guys that couldn't do anything else. Let's make them pastors. It should be men who are qualified and could do all kinds of other things, but God calls them into this particular kind of ministry.
Yeah. I don't want to go too far out on a limb, but I've kind of been kicking around a podcast episode critiquing missions as well, because I feel like Not everyone, and I obviously our church does their due diligence on who we support and stuff, but I've had experience with a lot of people that would try five or six different business endeavors and not be able to do well at it. Mm-hmm. And then eventually kind of just fall into it because it's got this moniker where you can just, oh, I'm doing God's work now. Oh, okay. We'll pay. You couldn't earn a profit in the free market, or you wouldn't honor contracts in the free market and do a good job. And so now you can slap a Jesus sticker on it and everybody starts throwing money your way to actually not really work that hard compared to some of the stuff.
Yeah. And I can tell you, I've known a lot of really faithful, diligent, very hardworking pastors. I've known some pastors who worked too hard, quite frankly. But I've also known some really lazy pastors. And that's true in the mission field as well, where honestly, a lot of times there's even less accountability and less oversight. So yeah, it's one of those things where, I mean, you have to, it's really interesting to me that in First Timothy 3, as Paul is getting into the qualifications for pastoral ministry, he says, if a man has ambition to be a bishop, that's a good thing. So there has to be an ambition. There has to be a drive. There has to be this, which I think Paul himself modeled. Paul was incredibly ambitious. And even talks about that, like in Romans 15, it's his ambition to take the gospel where it hasn't been before. He was very ambitious as a missionary. We need ambitious pastors who want to grow their churches and have an influence. We need ambitious missionaries who want to, be like William Carey and win whole nations and whole continents to Christ. A lot of times I think we're not nearly ambitious enough.
Mm. Yeah. So, at what point did I can't do the math kind of on the fly. What point did your wife enter the picture?
So we met in college and got married basically the week after we graduated college. So we had one of those, what's been called a cornerstone marriage, where you kind of start out with nothing and build a life together, which has been great. We've loved it that way. So we got married right out of college. I took, quite frankly, a very low-paying job in Austin, Texas, to work with this church. She took an even lower-paying job to teach at a private Christian school, and we just went from there. And, we've kind of always had this sense that, this is what God has called us to, and, we've always wanted to be involved in the church and in things like Christian education, and God's just opened those doors for us over the years. Obviously, once kids came along, she was I want to say a stay-at-home mom, because I never think that really captures everything, but she was a true homemaker in, in every sense of the term, raising our kids. And then when they got a good bit older, she teaches part-time at a classical Christian school here close to us, actually the one where my kids went. So,
okay. And so you guys were, you're probably, if you're getting married right out of college, you're wading through the professional thing while you're still engaged, but very much talking about it. And that's kind of was a stop on the road towards ministry to get married, or it happened after the fact, or how, I guess I'm always interested to hear how that vocational, how you're charting that course as a married couple and trying to figure things out.
My wife likes to joke that, there's a kind of bait and switch, because when we started dating each other, I was pre-med, so she thought she was going to marry a doctor. but here's the thing. She knew that I was going to be in pastoral ministry before I did. She kind of figured out that that's really where I needed to be. And like I said, the campus pastor that I had came, and he kind of turned the screws on me and said, it's kind of like a Pharaoh going to Calvin saying, you've got to stay here in Geneva and help us or your studies will be cursed, kind of thing. It's like, how do you say no to that? It was kind of a, arm twisting. This is what you need to do. Okay. Yes. Actually, now I see the light. You're right. That's what I need to go do. But she had kind of already figured that out even before I had, I think. And, so.
Nice. Yeah. Yeah. Do you know the name Peter Doyle? I imagine you do.
I sure do. Yep. Went to
my parents both graduated from Auburn, and then we're under him, going through school, and still
I was under him as well.
Yeah. They, sent me a photo. They were at dinner with him last week or the week before.
Wow.
We actually read his his books that he published, I think originally with Focus on the Family,
The Adventures and Odyssey books.
Yeah, there were the Daring Adventure series or whatever.
And then
he also had the American Revolution ones as well. And we got them actually off the typewriter in a manila folder before they were published. Like my dad actually read them to us before the editor took out some of the Marshall things in the like it was pretty crazy. Like we read the end up reading the ones that got published and we're like, what? She shot above the guy in the actual book. She shot him and killed him, you know, like,
well, you know, Dr. Joel, he was one of my favorites, you know, so he was the one. So when I was in, you know, I was in college and I was going to his church, I was sitting under his preaching, wonderful preacher. And also, he did a college men's Bible study. Mm-hmm. And it was incredibly helpful because he, more than anyone else I had been around to that point, he was able to talk about men and women, the mm-hmm. differences between men and women, our unique callings and unique glories as men and women, roles within marriage and how those roles are rooted in our natures. He just did an incredible job. And it really, you know, it was one of those things that it was definitely something I was interested in, obviously, you know, as somebody who wants to be a student of scripture, but I didn't really have a whole lot of direction. And I'm so thankful. I mean, even looking back on things now, there are things that he said when I sat under his ministry as a college student that I still think of all the time. That is just very formative. I remember he gave us a book to read called Man and Woman in Christian Perspective by this German theologian, Werner Neuer. And I remember thinking, you know, some modern German theologian, how could he possibly have anything useful to say about men and women? Just assuming that it had to be some kind of liberalism or egalitarianism is going to be, you know, snuck in through the back door. But read the book and found it to be an amazing book, incredibly biblical and I would say, you know, conservative, traditional in its outlook on the sexes, and super helpful. He had made a number of other reading recommendations that were really helpful. So yeah, sitting in his Bible study and all of that, very, very helpful, very formative in my own understanding of a theology of the sexes. And he definitely painted a picture of marriage that was very attractive and compelling, where you would want to get married. You know, so many young people today just have no real interest or desire in marriage. They don't see anything glorious about marriage. But he really helped us see the glory of marriage, where man and woman together are a symbol of the gospel in their relationship with each other and what that means. So just, I'm so thankful for his ministry. That's great that you've got a connection with him as well. And I will say this, his books do a great job, and obviously they have been sanitized somewhat. I do remember him talking about that, but yeah. His books did a great job of sort of pulling out those differences between boys and girls, men and women. And, you know, to me, he's kind of like Chesterton. I know Chesterton gets a lot of things wrong. He's not really trustworthy as a theologian or a historian, but Chesterton delighted in the differences between the sexes. Mm-hmm. And there's just kind of this jovial outlook on marital life for that reason. And Dr. Doyle really had the same kind of thing, really captured that just being fascinated by and enjoying the differences between men and women, those God ordained differences between us. And that was really a wonderful thing.
Well, and he sitting at their table too, and watching him, you know, he's not only preaching about it, teaching about it, but if you ever get to sit and watch him interact with his wife,
I did,
and just how pleasant, you know, and he would make those like kind of the chauvinistic almost jokes about, now, dear, you know, whatever. And she'd just roll her eyes, you know, it was just like a funny banter between them that just was hilarious. And she's brilliant and cultivating all kinds of different skills and training, you know, young women and all that stuff too. It's just it's an example. I think it's one of those things that you don't really realize until you're out in the big wide world what a gift it was to kind of be exposed to that in formative years.
Their relationship in that way kind of makes me think this must have been what Martin Luther and Katie were like in their interactions with each other, mm-hmm. kind of this playful banter. You know, whenever I talk about headship and submission as, you know, what the man is called to in marriage, what the woman is called to. I always liken it to a dance, you know, where the man mm-hmm. leads and the woman follows. She's not passive. She's active as a follower, but she is following his lead. So he's initiating, she's responding, all that. And when you are around a couple that has a really faithful and biblically oriented marriage, just their daily life kind of feels like you're witnessing a dance. I mean, they're not on mm-hmm. the dance floor. They're engaging maybe over the dinner table or wherever, but it feels like there's a dance going on between these two people. And, mm-hmm. and that was always the sense that I had when I was around them.
And yeah, and I think that the indication too, is I've said with other guests on the podcast, is if you witness that dance and people embracing that role of headship and submission, as you phrased it, and it, nobody's looking at that woman and thinking, oh, poor her, she's so oppressed. Right, you know, she, right. It's right. It's vibrant. It's a demeanor and a kind of meta narrative of their life is just overflowing creativity and joy. And
right.
And it's in a sense, the things that she wouldn't have to normally, you know, the feminist agenda will prop it up as like all these things you get to be in charge of and you don't need a man, that actually beat you down as a woman when there's not someone else to handle that, that some of that external security kind of things and all the different things. So I think it's,
yeah, that's exactly right. And so it contradicts everything that our culture says about the male female relationship. Everything our culture says about intersexual dynamics is just wrong. So our culture thinks that the key to female happiness is feminism. And so, you know, you get some feminism and then women are not real happy about it. So then they double down and want even more feminism. So they get more of it and then they're even more miserable. And I saw this morning where, you know, now it's like we have unprecedented levels of female unhappiness trickling down even to, you know, teenage girls and preteen girls. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what's going on? Why all of this female misery? Well, it's because that they are rebelling against the way God designed them to live. They're rebelling against their own nature. They're rebelling against God's word, God's law, and God's calling for them. But then you look at a marriage like, you know, so what a feminist would call oppressive, because it's biblical, where there's clear, you know, clearly the man is the head and the woman is in submission to him. And yet the woman is gloriously happy. And we've had people come and join our church who have said the same thing. I've had several people even in the last few years tell me this. It seems like especially more recently it's happened, where people joining our church and they'll say, you know, one of the things that stood out to us is that in your church, the men are men and the women are women and everybody's happy about that. Like the men are clearly the leaders and the heads of their households and the women are really happy about it. And that really stood out. And I'm like, well, great. You know, praise God. That's what we want. And that's what we would expect to see.
Yeah, we've gotten lots of comments from people coming in and just saying, you know, the men singing as well. Mm-hmm. There's just a different feel that male voices in the, you know, singing out loud. There's a church militant aspect to it that resonates for guys coming in. I mean, there's some guys have come in and said, I have not experienced anything like that. You know, in a long time.
True. Yeah. And so, I mean, and actually that's another great metaphor to use for this kind of thing is, you know, like singing it, say in a choir or a congregation singing in parts. What mm-hmm. feminism or what egalitarianism does is it says, hey, if women want their voices to be heard, they've got to sing the bass part.
Uh-huh.
Okay. But women can't do that. They can't, they'll never be able to hit the bass notes the way a man can. But feminism says, that's what you have to do to make your voice be heard, to make it count. And then, of course, quite honestly, with egalitarianism, they've got the men trying to sing the soprano part. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't work. It goes. So what I say is, look, men and women, you know, we're both made in the image of God. We you know, in that sense, you can talk about equality between men and women. We have equal worth, equal value, all that, equal redemption, all, you know, all that you can say is equal between men and women. But What we really have to emphasize, I think, in our cultural context are these God-ordained differences between men and women that are absolutely glorious. Mm-hmm. You need men singing their part. You need women singing their part. And it's going to be a disaster if they try to sing each other's parts. Mm-hmm. But that's what our culture is pressing people to do.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, I mean, it's for those that have their head screwed on straight. It's a circus more than it is anything that is awe-inspiring.
Totally agree.
So let's shift over to the why you should bring your gun to church. I mentioned kind of pre-interview, I think that some of the reason why men, and I know Larson and I talked last week just a little bit about this, about how there's this, it feels effeminate and it feels homosexual in some way, like, hey, Jesus needs to be your boyfriend. And there's this in the big evangelical culture in some ways that men feel like they have to put their man card in the slot outside when they go through the front door of church. And then maybe they get it back however fast they can get out the door and grab their man card and go back to the Super Bowl or the different things. What are, as a pastor, in observing these kind of trends, comment on that and how you kind of the unique time in history that the church finds itself, and then in some of the ways why we're experiencing in our particular circles of church historic growth and why that is.
Yeah. One thing that I think we need to be really clear about is that it is impossible for one sex to thrive while the other flounders. So, you know, you'll hear some people talk about, well, there's a crisis amongst men. Men are in crisis. Men are dropping out of the workforce. Men are living in their parents' basements when they should be out getting jobs and starting families. There's a failure of boys to launch into manhood. Warren Farrell's talked about the boyhood crisis and how boys are struggling in school. Male suicide is really high. You can talk about all those kind of things, and all that's true. There is a crisis amongst men, but the way God has made the world and the way God has designed the sexes to relate, it is impossible for one sex to succeed while the other fails. Okay, that's actually the lie of feminism. And it's really, I mean, I frequently say that feminism was really the first form of identity politics in American history, because it separated out women as a distinct group, and ultimately with women's suffrage, a voting bloc, a political group, and said women have interests of their own that might be contrary to men's interests or their husband's interest or even their children's interests. Women have their own interests. They're their own interest group. And that's a disaster, obviously. It's a disaster for marriage, and it's a disaster for the family and the household. But what I think is really important to understand is that if men are struggling, women are too. It may not show up the same way, but if men are floundering, women are too. If there's a crisis in masculinity, there's a corresponding crisis in femininity. So there are people who will say, oh, well, you know, men are really struggling and women are doing great because more women are going to college than ever before. And women are doing this, doing that. You know, at the Super Bowl, I hear we had the first all-female flyover. Okay. You know, like, I don't know why we're supposed to celebrate that since men have been doing this for years. What's the big deal? But, you know, they make a huge deal out of stuff like that. Well, that does not mean that women are doing well. And actually, when they, and I made reference to this before, but when they do, you know, these surveys of things like happiness and well-being and whatnot, women are, you know, the modern woman is largely a miserable creature. And again, this is because women and men stand or fall together. We will either succeed together or fail together. But you can't really have a battle of the sexes where one wins and the other loses. That's just not the way the world works. So there is a crisis in masculinity. The church has lost its men by and large. The church has very little that appeals to men. And this has been going on for a really long time. And you can trace out the history of this. You know, if you read, like, I know Leon Podlis' book, I think that's how you say his name. I think it's called The Church Impotent. You know, traces this back to medieval times. I'm a little bit skeptical of that thesis because there's just too much intervening history and too many times when the church has done quite well with men in the intervening centuries. But in general, in the modern West, particularly going back to, say, the 19th century, church has not really had much appeal to men. The church culture in America and in Western culture in general has been very feminized. It's become very effeminate. Some of that is the music that you mentioned. It's, you know, kind of Jesus is my girlfriend type music. Some of that is that the men who went into the pastorate were often repulsive to men in general because they were very effeminate. They were weak. They were cowardly. and that was manifested in their preaching. Some of it is that the church adopted feminine forms of piety and spirituality and elevated them, so that in a lot of 19th and early 20th century literature, especially, it's almost as if women are angels, men are demons, and it's like you'll have, basically women are put almost in the place of the Holy Spirit in a way. Very often in various forms of literature, fiction and nonfiction, women's spirituality elevated above men's, which makes it seem like spirituality is for women, and then, men do kind of all the rugged stuff out in the world that has nothing to do with God or Jesus or the Bible. This is reflected in a lot of, say country music. It's kind of a common theme in country music where, grandpa cusses and chews tobacco, and grandma knows every hymn in the hymn book kind of thing. That mm-hmm. kind of motif is really, really common. So, grandma's a saint, grandpa's a sinner kind of thing. And there's just that's been a very common motif. And so churches, even churches that have all male officers, have basically become matriarchies. Where women really determine the culture of the church, and it becomes a very feminized environment that is rather repulsive to most men. Men, and especially blue collar type men, walk in and they can immediately tell this is not a place for them in any kind of way. Mm-hmm. And the music and preaching and just the overall culture of the place is just repels them. In the meantime. And you made reference to this. In the meantime, you've got all of these particularly online figures that have emerged that have a very viable message for men. Now, it's inadequate. It's distorted. There's all kinds of problems with it, but it has a real appeal to men. So you've got the Jordan Petersons and the Joe Rogans and all these kind of, they're mostly secular figures who have developed huge followings among men. And it's because they actually understand men's issues and men's concerns, and they're giving men practical, actionable advice that in many cases, even though, these teachers may be missing the big picture in the sense that they don't have Christ, they don't have the wisdom that comes from God's world, they've paid attention enough to the way the world actually works that they can give some advice that is sound and in many cases superior to the feminized advice that men would be getting from pastors or in their churches. And so there's been this real disconnect between men and the church. And then you've got men who are gravitating towards these other kinds of figures and basically, using somebody like a Jordan Peterson as a kind of surrogate pastor, or in some cases a surrogate father, since, you've mm-hmm. also got this whole issue of now with the breakup of the family in our culture, with, half the kids in America being raised in broken homes. You've got you've got a whole generation of boys who are looking for a father figure, and they'll latch on to anybody who seems to have a message that resonates deep within them, that seems to connect with their masculinity and their masculine instincts. So yeah, the church has missed badly on this, and it's a real problem.
So what do you think? I know that it's not a good tactic to replicate, even though the church has done it, replicate a rock concert model or a seeker sensitive, if you will, type model for flashy marketing campaigns and influencer pastors and things like that. But I know you're engaged in some new mediums, some podcasting, some things like that. And also I'm sure that there's local men's things happening in your circles. So what are some of the things that, obviously we have a view that the death has been conquered, Christ is victorious, and so we have this confidence. We can have this confidence as men. I've spoke about it before that when I was on the battlefield, the Stonewall Jackson quote about, being as safe on the battlefield as you are bed at night. Like I've experienced that, the peace of the gospel, the reality, the finality of what Christ did. And make me fearless on the battlefield. And also in some ways now people, hey, what do you got about this, Nate? These different, issues with the military, issues with men and stuff. It's like, well, I, I got to raise my sons well, and that's, you know, do good business and then, you know, model like you just talked about. Are they looking, are my kids looking at my wife and my dance with her and thinking, mm-hmm. I want that, you know?
Well, and there's so many things here to talk about. And we'll barely scratch the surface in the time we have together in terms of what needs to be done. But I'll throw a few things out because I think sometimes the wrong prescription is offered. So, for example, you mentioned, you know, rock band, you know, kind of using a rock band in church. I don't think there's anything particularly masculine about a rock concert. In mm-hmm. fact, isn't it interesting that long before we had transgenderism, like as a mainstream thing, I mean, you know, I grew up in the 80s. Okay. Yeah. I mean, all the hard rock and heavy metal bands, all these men were incredibly effeminate. You know, they're limp wristed, long hair with lots of hairspray, makeup. I mean, I never really understood how that worked, why these you know, guys who are playing electric guitar, feel like they need to dress and act like women. And but there's something weirdly unnatural about it. And I'm not saying that's what happens with churches that have rock bands. Hopefully not. But I don't think that's the answer. David Murrow, you know, he wrote the book, I think it's called Why Men Hate Going to Church. And there's a lot mm-hmm. of good counsel in his book. There's also a lot of stuff that I think just kind of misses. Like one of the things I recall him saying is, well, you know, men like technology. So, you know, become a high-tech church and get the men involved in that. I don't think that's an answer. I don't think that really matters. I don't think that really does anything. Mm-hmm. I don't think it really matters whether you're high-tech or low-tech. I don't think that's how you're going to keep men in the church by having, you know, the latest, you know, gadgets or tech stuff, whatever.
I think I probably made it 60% of the way through that book on Audible and then was like, I get what he's saying. Like, I don't need to finish this anymore.
I mean, it's not that everything he says is bad. It's just, I think he misses what's most important. Here's some things I would say, like if I was, you know, in terms of just the recipe, one is, I think you have to have preaching that is masculine. I mean, why has God ordained the pastorate in such a way that it's only open to men? There mm-hmm. is something manly about the work itself. Pastoring is masculine work. And if you can't see that, like if you think about what your pastor does and you think, oh, a woman could do that just as well, then your pastor's not doing it right. Mm-hmm. Because it ought to be obvious that he's doing things that have a kind of masculine flavor to them, whether that is rebuking error or whether that's teach. I mean, the reality is men and women communicate differently. And it's a well-known fact that when women communicate, they tend to, for example, turn declarations into questions and their voice kind of gets higher at the end of the sentence because they're sort of beckoning to you for agreement, like they want affirmation with their statement. Whereas men just tend, you know, traditionally men have just spoken in much more plain spoken and much more direct in their speech. Well, I think we need to be really direct and plain in our speech. If men are called to preach, then we ought to sound like men when we preach. You know, if only men can be pastors, then we ought to put on display regularly those masculine facets of the pastoral work. So that's a big part of it. I think preaching courageously against the error, you know, basically being willing to stand against the tide of whatever is going on in the world and pushing back against that. So much, you know, so many churches today pander to the world in various ways. I think you saw this. Even in more conservative reformed churches, I saw lots of pandering over the LGBTQ stuff mm-hmm. and really weird rhetoric used to try to tiptoe around the homosexual issue. Like, you know, we shouldn't say that homosexuality condemns people to hell because being heterosexual doesn't save you. What an absolutely idiotic thing to say. Mm. Or the Bible whispers about sexual sin. Again, what kind of fool would say something like that? I mean, what Bible are you reading? It's just one of the mm-hmm. dumbest things I've ever heard. You know, but people say, men say stuff like this from the pulpit, and all I can think is, you're just a coward. You just don't want to say what the Bible says. Mm-hmm. So I think you have to have preaching that is clearly masculine because God only calls men to preach. you know, so there's got to be something masculine about the work itself. The music, I mean, not every hymn has to be a, you know, war song of some sort, but there ought to be a lot of hymns that clearly have a martial orientation. And if you go back before the advent of revivalism in church history, you find a lot of that kind of music that's very martial in its orientation. We need to remember that worship is warfare. And so at least some of our hymns ought to clearly reflect that dimension of what we're doing when we gather for worship. I think in the prayers that we offer, again, the prayers ought to reflect the priorities of God's kingdom, which is going to take courage to pray for certain things and against other things. We should not be afraid of imprecation in our prayer. And then I think one of the things that would be most helpful, I mean, obviously, you know, discipling men, teaching men about, for example, what it means to be a husband, what it means to be a father, all of that, but then supporting them in it. I've seen far too many situations where churches that would profess to believe every word Paul wrote in Ephesians 5, when it comes down to it and there's, say, a marital crisis, the pastor or the session, and this is something that's just widespread in our culture, they default to the woman's point of view. They tell the man, well, if you just loved her more like Christ loves the church, then this wouldn't be happening to you. And some of this, I think, is they're much more afraid of confronting the woman's sins than the man's sins. I mean, the reality is in most every single time when you have a marital breakdown, you have sin on both parts. You know, both the husband and wife have sinned in various ways. But I've seen all too many counseling type situations, pastoral situations where only the man's sin got dealt with and the woman got a free pass and her sin was always excused. Whatever he did, that somehow excused her sin. I think if we're going to teach that, you know, men need to be men and men need to be the heads of their households, then we have to support them in that and support their authority within their own households. Now, that doesn't mean we don't rebuke men. I mean, obviously we do when they misuse that authority, and some men do become tyrants in their own homes, and that's got to be dealt with. Some men become abusive, and that's got to be dealt with. There should be no patience for that, no tolerance for that. But a lot of times in kind of run-of-the-mill, ordinary situations where, you know, a marriage just runs into some trouble, there's sin on both parts. And the assumption of everybody going in is, well, obviously, this is all the man's fault. Women don't really sin. And so we need to correct the man, and then that'll put the marriage back on track. Well, no, there's probably things that she needs to hear as well. She probably needs to be rebuked as well. And one of the things that stands out to me, particularly about Paul's pastoral epistles, is that he is unflinching and unhesitating in addressing the sins of women. And Paul addresses very stereotypical sins for men and very stereotypical sins for women. Why don't we do that in the church today? Why is there such a reluctance to deal with the sins that tend to be sex specific? You just don't really do a lot of that. So I would say teaching men about the authority and responsibility they have in their homes, but then also supporting them in the exercise of that authority and the fulfillment of those responsibilities in their homes is also really crucial. I mean, I could tell you one story after another of situations where, you know, and this might be in a, you know, what would be considered a, you know, a good PCA church or some other kind of reformed church, and the wife commits adultery and ends up leaving her husband for another man and never gets disciplined for it. And the only thing that ever happened in their counseling was he was told to do a better job loving her. And it's like, well, is there anything more? And I'm not really exaggerating here at all. I mean, I've seen this play out more than once. And so we have to be willing to confront the sins of both spouses. And so if a man is going to meet with his pastor or his session to help, you know, deal with a problem in his marriage, he needs to know that, yes, they're going to confront me about my sin. No question about that. I get that. You know, my wife will let them know the things I've done wrong. And insofar as her assessment is accurate, they're going to rebuke me for that. But he also needs to know that his pastor and his session have his back and will back him up when it comes to the proper exercise of his authority in the home as a husband and as a father. And I think very often that doesn't happen. And I think that's one reason why men are very reluctant to go seek help in their marriages, because there's really not, it doesn't seem like there's really much help there. There's really not anything that can be done about a rebellious wife because nobody wants to stand up to her. So that's another issue here that I think if churches got the reputation for being much more even-handed in dealing with the sins of men and women both, I think you would see more men take an interest in the church and what the church might be able to do for them and how the church might be able to help them through some hard times.
Yeah, that's an excellent, excellent point. And I think I've recently spoke with my pastor about particular, you know, couples that are having trouble and things. And he remarked that, that it's almost like a last ditch effort when they finally involved the session or the men of the church. It's like, you should have come to us a long time ago in some sense. And that is, I think that is indicative of men generally. It's hard for us to open up about how we failed. And so we got to get over that. And we need to have brotherhood in the sense that we have relationship that nobody thinks we're perfect. Like, you're not able to keep the facade up when you're in community. And so it's even that much easier to just say, yep, you know the deal. Like, I have this struggle. You've been with me on this. But at the same time, like, I think that's a really good point too, to say, is he going to come and get help when he thinks he's going to get backed up, you know? And there can be
let's say you have a wife who has a spending problem. Mm-hmm. And he's done everything he knows how to do to rein it in, but she still puts too much on the credit card every month. Okay. Mm-hmm. What can he do at that point? Well, so let's say he goes to your typical evangelical pastor today, his pastor is probably not going to do anything to correct the woman, but just tell him he needs to do X, Y, and Z better. And if he mm-hmm. only did better, if he only loved her more as Christ loves the church or something like that, then she wouldn't have this spending problem. And her sin never gets dealt with. And again, I'm not making these things up. I've seen these things play out again and again, you know, in situations that I'm familiar with. And so it's just really, it's one-sided, and it's reflective of things that are going on in the culture, where women are pedestalized and men are denigrated. I mean, all you have to do is look at anything in pop culture, you know, any TV show, movie, whatever. Men are always portrayed as incompetent, bumbling idiots, and women are portrayed as basically can do no wrong, and anything they choose is fully justified. That's just the narrative in the culture right now. And it seeped into the church. Let me shift gears here a little bit and give you one more thing, sort of one more ingredient. If the church wants to reach men and minister to men, something else the church needs to do. So, I mean, you know, several of the things I mentioned to you, I think are crucial, but this one is really, really important as well. And that is to provide venues and support for male friendship and male bonding. And that means the recovery of male spaces. I mean, this is another thing that's under attack, is that men are not allowed to have their own spaces anymore. Now, in the church, I realize that we do, you know, we do have that some, in the culture at large, not so much. But the church needs to do what it can to support male friendship. And that's because many men go through life now experiencing excruciating loneliness without any real companionship. And men have got to have brothers. They've got to have, you know, every David needs a Jonathan and every Jonathan needs a David. You need to have men with whom you are good friends, with whom you can share your struggles and your burdens, with whom you can be very transparent and open yourself up to accountability and hard questions and all of that. There needs to be a venue for forming deep male friendships within the church. Men, once they get out of college, men just have a hard time maintaining friendships. We get busy with family life and pursuing our careers and whatnot, and it seems like those friendships get squeezed out, but they're really crucial to our well-being spiritually, and probably, you know, physically and in other ways as well. But we've got to find ways to support and encourage friendships amongst men.
That's really good. I guess it's reflecting on how I have that in my church and maybe don't necessarily think about how critical that is to not experiencing that, being excited to go and have concentric rings that get bigger too. You have two or three guys that you're particularly close with, and then it right. moves out and there's a larger, you know, right. we have a 30 or 40 men on a group text, and then a couple group texts with one or two others that they're different things that you can talk about or different levels of transparency. And that feeds into in-person stuff.
You can't be best friends with everybody, obviously, but mm-hmm. you need to have think about Jesus. Jesus has multitudes of people that he's around regularly. So huge groups of people. Then he's got the 12, which is his inner circle. And then he's got the three, Peter, James, and John, kind of the inner circle of the inner circle, the innermost ring, if you will. And that's not being cliquish. That's actually just, I mean, that's how friendships work. You can't be best friends with everybody. Friendships, in the very nature of the case, have a kind of exclusivity to them. But every man needs to have a band of brothers in his life. Every man needs to have a circle of friends that he can rely on, that he can count on, that he can be honest with. And I think that's one of the best things. I mean, you want to talk about helping men do better in work and in marriage and as fathers. This is, I think, actually one of the things that would contribute the most to that is if we had these, if we had strong and healthy male friendships within the church.
What are some of the ways that you've seen that accomplished well in your circles? In any particular, one of the things I call people out on is to show up. You know, You can't race out the back door of church, you know, at the second to last note of the last hymn and round your kids up, like hang out in the lobby for a little bit and chat, you know, like,
absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you have, yeah. So I would say show up is a huge part of it. You know, so be a part of what your wider church community is doing. And I would say make it a priority and put the effort into it. You know, you think back to the things that you did that, and I think that men really bond. I mean, obviously men need to have conversation with each other. We're doing a conversation here and, you know, I get together with men in my church for lunch and that kind of thing. I do, you know, phone calls, texts, all that kind of thing. But, you know, so all that's really important. But I also think that men very often bond over, a shared mission of some sort. Mm-hmm. So common projects, work that we do together. I remember, I think it's Dorothy Sayers in her book on work talks about how, you know, a man, I think he was either like a lawyer or a doctor, you know, after the war was over, but he talked about how much he missed his days in the military during the war, because mm-hmm. it was the one time in his life when he really had close male friendships. Mm-hmm. And you think, well, that's kind of sad. It shouldn't be that way. You know, we shouldn't have to be in the military in the middle of a combat situation in order to have good male friends. Although there's no question that good friendships come out of that. But it shouldn't be, you know, we should be able to have good friendships, period. And yeah. And I think that friendship, you know, being married well, being married happily requires a certain set of virtues and skills that you have to work at and that you can master over time. You know, you may not be a good husband when you first get married, but you can become one if you're willing to learn what the office of being a husband requires of you. And I would say the same is largely true of friendship. You know, you have men who maybe are not very skilled in forming friendships, but if they will work at it, they can form friendships over time. They may have to ask for some really honest and hard to hear feedback. You know, what are some things I'm doing that are hindering my friendships? Just like a husband might have to ask that of his wife or of somebody else, if he's going to be a better husband, you know, you need that, honest and forthright feedback. But I think any man should be able to form close friendships if he's really willing to make it a priority and pour himself into it.
Yeah. I think probably too, if you are working at being a good husband, that also may lend to having friends. Cause if you don't have your wife under control, you're not getting invited over anywhere.
Right. Or your kids, you know, if your kids are out of control. So, yeah.
Awesome. Well, I know we got on the interview a little bit late and I don't want to take too much of your time. I will obviously link all the stuff in the show notes. I've benefited from the content you and Larson are putting out. There's some sermons that have benefited me, but what's the ways that people can engage with what you're putting out?
Yeah, this is great. Thank you again so much for having me on. You've got a great podcast, and glad to be a part of this. I didn't even know we had the connection with Dr. Doyle before we started talking, so that was great to hear. Our church website is trinity-pres.net. So if you search for Trinity Presbyterian Church Birmingham, we should come up, but it's trinity-pres.net. And that's got all sermons, Sunday school, and then there's actually a link there that will take you to the pastor's page where I blog very occasionally. I'm not a Doug Wilson when it comes to blogging, but every now and then I'll blog something. And it's got some conference audio and things like that. You mentioned my talk, Take Your Guns to Church. You can find that on there. And a number of other conference talks that I've given and things of that nature. So that's how people can find me. I do a podcast every other week or so with Larson Hicks called God a Minute. So if you search for God a Minute and my name or Larson's name, that should come up for you.
Awesome. Well, I appreciate your time, Pastor Les, taking time away for what you got going on locally and contributing to kind of the greater church movement. And thanks for your time.
Appreciate it. Glad to do it, Nathan. Thanks a lot.
What a conversation, right? All the books that we talked about, the Pastor's Corner on the church website, the links to the God a Minute podcast, etc., are all located in the show notes and on the podcast episode page on our website, spearing.co. As always, I really appreciate it. You just take the time to open your podcast app, give us a 5-star review, maybe drop a line in the comments section why you reviewed it such to help direct other people, to help get the algorithm working in our favor to help people that are trying to hit the mark in their life. Also, share it with a friend. If it helped you, if we provide a value, pass it along to someone. Maybe schedule a time to link up with them in person to discuss some of the topics. And as always, have a good one.